This is the story of the bands who released the first ever British punk rock single. Containing strong language, we ask the question...
Is she really going out with him?
Draw far, shoot straight, but don't hit the bystanders. That was the Damned.
One of the top three bands. I mean, there's them, the Sex Pistols and the Clash. That's it. I mean, that's English punk.
Yeah, and they were a little different from the other bands. They weren't like a political band. They were more musical.
They were part of punk's Big Three. But while the Sex Pistols gained more notoriety and the Clash more credibility, it was the Damned who did it first. With Dave Vanian's opening line, "Is she really going out with him?" and the rapid-fire drum beat of Rat Scabies, punk rock had a sound.
I got a feeling inside of me. It's kind of strange, like a stormy sea.
It was October 22nd, 1976, that New Rose was released on Dave Robinson's Stiff Records.
I got a new rose, I got a good.
Yeah, it was very important to be the first. Yeah, in my mind, yeah, that was my ambition. Was we would be the first. Yeah, definitely.
Captain Sensible was the Damned's bassist.
I mean, we were the first, and that's possibly because, you know, some of the other greedy bastard bands who were starting at the time, the Clash and the Pistols and that, they were holding out for big major record labels to come dangling kind of wads of cash in front of their noses.
Being first wasn't the band's doing, but the ambition of the Damned's manager. According to drummer Rat Scabies.
It was one of Jake Riviera's big things, was it? He always said, you've got to be the first to do everything, and we'll get the f***ing first punk record out, and we'll take you to America, because we think that's where it will happen for you, and all the rest of it. And we were in such a sort of drunken days, we didn't really care, sort of straight off the Dole office.
The Damned actually did it the punk way, I thought. You know, we signed to a small independent label with great ideas. Stiff Records, you know, and so that's how we were first. You know, it was not because the Pistols couldn't have put an album together, but they did wait for a big major record label, and they did spend an inordinate amount of time, you know, getting it all slickly produced, which I thought was a crap idea in the first place. I mean, you compare the Damned to the Pistols, and one of them's raw and punk, and the other one, if you took Johnny Rotten off, you know, would sound like Bad Company.
It's kind of strange, like a stormy sea.
The song was written by the band's guitarist, Brian James.
It wasn't a kind of race. There was no race at all. It just so happened that we was fortunate enough to have become friends with Jake, and for him to offer us a deal, and Jake being the kind of guy that don't f*** around, he had us in the studio before we'd signed the contract. I mean, as it happened, like bands like the Pistols and the Clash, they decided to kind of go corporate and sign with your EMIs and your CBSs and stuff like that. They were happy to deal with the suits, whereas we really didn't want to.
New Rose predated the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK by 5 weeks. Pistols songwriter and bassist Glenn Matlock.
The thing with the movement, there were four bands that were really kind of making tracks in some kind of tandem but not known about each other. They were the Sex Pistols, obviously. The Stranglers were around pretty much the same time. The Jam and the Damned, all playing around as early as 75, maybe even Stranglers even before then, because they came out of the back of the pub rock thing. So they were your main four protagonists of the punk thing. Anything else was kind of Johnny-come-latelys, I think. So hats off to the Damned for kind of not getting on any bandwagon. They were doing it.
New Rose was produced by Nick Lowe, who had met the band a short time before in France.
The Mont de Marsan Festival, sort of legendary bus trip. It was a sort of a nightmare trip, but anyway, they were on it, and they were mouthy, and they kept on calling me granddad. You know, I think I was 26. but anyway, they were quite cheeky, but I thought they were great. And then they made such a sort of commotion that Jake Riviera, who had just started Stiff Records at that time, offered them a record deal. And because I was the house producer at Stiff, I was drafted into... Well, I didn't really produce them, you know, they did it themselves, but I always found my role as a producer back then anyway as an egger on, really. I used to try and egg them on to go further and further, and that's what they did. It actually didn't take very much egging on at all to do that.
Also on the scene, as DJ at the Roxy, a venue that put on a lot of the earliest punk bands, was punk chronicler Don Letts.
I mean, a lot was made of, you know, it being the first punk rock single, which I'm guessing was more to do with Stiff than the guys themselves. And they made such a big deal out of it, it almost put us off. But what was more important is that it was a good single. And I think that got up everybody's noses much more than the fact that it was the first single.
They were really good. They were a really, really good group. And indeed, the whole punk rock scene, I was a bit old for it. You know, I was saying that they used to call me granddad. I was a bit old for it. The music I pretty much loathed, you know, pretty much all of it. But the actually what it was doing, the scene and how anything went, it was a sort of back to year zero, at the time was fantastic fun. And that was what was most exciting. But the Damned were really good. And it wasn't really until we started recording that I could hear that. They were great.
Well, I would have heard New Rose well before its release, you know, several times down the Roxy. And that and Neat, Neat, Neat were my personal favourites. Those two tracks definitely rocked and seemed to capture the essence of punk. I guess one of the attractive things about New Rose is that it wasn't overtly political. You know, they weren't standing on a soapbox. It did harken back to sort of more traditional rock and roll themes, but with a very punk rock delivery. Short, sharp, fast, and, you know, then they were out of here. It was like, draw far, shoot straight, but don't hit the bystanders. That was the Damned.
So was there any jealousy towards the Damned for doing it first from Glenn Matlock and the Pistols?
Not with us, there wasn't. We just wanted to make the best job possible, and they wanted to be the quickest. I'd rather make the best job possible. And, you know, things take time sometimes. And, there was some quote from Captain Sensible about, you know, he thought when he first heard Anarchy, it sounded like Bad Company. Well, I don't know if it does sound like Bad Company, but there's a certain kind of majesty and aplomb to Anarchy in the UK. And when we first started recording, the people who were the producers at the time wanted it to be faster and faster and faster, and we flatly refused to let that happen. We thought it was better to be more kind of select somehow, you know. Take your time. A great actor comes on stage, he doesn't rush on and mumble his words and then scoot off. You know, he takes his time with his delivery, and that's what we wanted to do, you know, to get the message across.
But it did matter to the Pistols manager, Malcolm McLaren, who had a seething rivalry with Damned manager, Jake Riviera, and his partner, Stiff Records label boss, Dave Robinson.
I mean, the Sex Pistols and the Damned didn't really get along. Malcolm hated us, generally, and didn't like the idea of the Damned. It was kind of a bit, because the Sexes were his creation entirely. The Damned were a pain in the ass because they were happening without Malcolm. So we thought, right, well, we'll put our stuff out first. You know, that'll piss you off. And of course it did, big time. Because he thought, well, ours is real punk and that's not the real, you know, and there was a lot of this who's the real punk at the time. It was great. It was kind of rock and roll.
I thought they was cut from the same cloth, but they didn't sound anything like us. They all kind of had long hair as well, you know. And there was a slight comedic aspect to them with Dave Vanian and his sort of love of Hammer horror and stuff like that. And Captain Sensible being a bit wacky. And Rat just being this mad sort of Keith Moon-style drummer. But, you know, they weren't sartorially in the same league as us, we felt, anyway. But they was doing what they was doing, and that was fine by me. And I got quite kind of chummy with them over a period of time.
Punk rock was pretty much just an ugly rumour to anyone outside London back in 76. The few who frequented the Roxy, Nashville or the 100 Club had seen the bands play, but for anyone else, it was just something that you could read about in the pages of Melody Maker or Sounds. You didn't know what it actually sounded like. Well, it sounded like this.
Is she really going out with him?
And I think Nick Lowe produced it. I think he chose the tune. I think that was kind of seen as his gig, but I think Jake liked it as well. And, you know,
that was it. And I mean, I agreed, and Rat agreed. Captain, I think, said no. I think it should be I Fall, which was another one of our songs. But everybody else just shouted him down, and he shut it up.
Because they'd seen us play at Mont de Masson at this festival there, and then on literally, you know, straight away the next day, Jake just said, right, we'll do a single, we'll do New Rose, Nick can produce it, and come in the studio on Monday. You know, it was one of those kind of deals. It wasn't, you know, and so
let's trust ourselves to this guy who seems like a really nice bloke. You know, first time Nick and Rat really met, They had a little scrap on the tour bus, you know, and Rat ripped his prized Eddie Cochran t-shirt off his back. And so there was a rapport there, you know what I mean? A kind of lad's rapport, if you like, you know. And
that's exactly what we did. We just turned up at this little studio with the equipment. It was Pathway in North London, in Islington somewhere, I think, around the back. Very, very small. You know, it was... there was a piano in there, which I remember thinking was a waste of space. But it was one of those where, you know, you had to squeeze around all of the mics every time you wanted to go for a piss, or you had to go and listen to a playback or something, you know. It was just... Everybody was kind of squidged up.
What's fantastic about it is that that you can hear each member of the group makes a big contribution to that record. Everything on that record, the bass and the drums and the guitar and the vocal, you can hear them all, and yet it makes one coherent sound. There's nothing sort of drowned out by anything else. And I don't know how that happened that day.
Just this riff. Didn't know what to do with it. One of those things you kind of file in the back of your mind and figure, I'll find a place for this at some point. I like this riff. It ain't going to go away. I like it too much. And then there was a ba 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 ba. I've got a feeling inside of me. Kind of strange, like a storm of sea. Just repeated that. And back into the thing, there you go.
There's a song called Jet Boy by the New York Dolls, which starts basically with a sort of like a hand clap type deal with just one guitar starting off, then another guitar comes on. But it's a very, very obvious intro.
And he said, but we can't just have that start like that, you know, because it's too much like the Dolls, because that's how the Dolls' Jet Boy starts, is just with the guitar playing that kind of riff. So I just sort of said, I know. I've got an idea.
Of course, when I played it to Rat, he did his own thing on it totally, and my idea of the drums, what I had in mind, you know, was something like, much more kind of like African or whatever, and he's just like, he gave it the Rat Scabies treatment, bang. The lyrics come out like, you wouldn't believe, just like in about 10 minutes or something.
Yeah, we set up and I was using a ropey old 1x18 Selmat cabinet and a ropey old valve amp. God knows where we got it from, but it produced a really kind of thunderous, farty noise, you know, which blended nicely with Brian's kind of his ultimate distortion noise with the riff meister, we used to call him, amongst other names. The Führer was one, because he would never kind of listen to anyone else's ideas, but he was right to, because he was a visionary and he knew something was happening, you know, and he wrote these terrific songs, you know, which became the first in Britain.
There was one, we went for it once to get the levels right, then put it down. That was it. Bang.
I can't remember why Dave said, is she really going out with him? I think it was because he wanted a bit of echo, I think, in his, to do the vocal. Because he just did that line, which is from Leader of the Pack, I think. And we just thought it sounded fantastic. You know, it didn't make any sense, you know, as far as the song went, and yet it sort of did.
I think because New Rose is basically a love song, I think it was about the Shangri-Las. I think the idea was that... we could have been the boys that they were singing about.
Is she really going out with him? And Nick just said that you know, like when he come to mix it, he said, I've left that on. I think it sounds great. It's the way it should start.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, the great thing about Nick Lowe was, as a producer, he understood that overproduction of a band like The Damned would have been disastrous. He ended up kind of underproducing us and just letting the tapes roll. And he would vibe the sessions along. I remember, you know, he'd walk in with like a plastic bag full of cider, you know, to jolly things along, which was, yeah, it was a pretty shrewd move.
I got excited, and so did the rest of them. That's why it gets faster, because that's what we want.
That was that. We used to do this real fast version of, well, it's fast in them days, fast version of Help, an old Beatles song. When I was younger, I'm much younger than today. Never needed anybody else to help me in any way. You stick that on the back, you know, because then you've got, like, sort of something that people can relate to a little bit, you know, and be either amazed by or f***ed
hate. I mean, I was the happiest f***ing guy in the world simply because if it all stops here, I don't care. This is mine. I wrote this f***ing song, this is my f***ing band, and it sounds great. And Nick had done a wonderful, wonderful job of it, you know. Great sound, great sound. Captured the live sound, exactly. No false little bits of stupidity on it or whatever. Just really, really good. He got a great, great drum sound. Don't know how he did it, should have taken notice, but just wasn't interested in them days. And, yeah, really, really good.
It was quite an experience, just hearing us back for the first time. It wasn't really what I thought we sounded like, but it was, took a while to come to terms with it. It was a very big moment, you know, very, very loud, you know, and just, well, I don't know, maybe you can imagine what it was like for me, you know. Never heard myself play before. And then the first thing I get is New Rose, the intro, New Rose coming back at like full tilt. With proper, you know, big, big sound. And just go, whoa, that's a rush. Yeah, that was good. It's something you never forget the first time you hear what you've done, you know. That's the whole point.
And they talked to people, so, oh, I remember where I was the first time I heard New Rose and all this, because it was the first English punk thing to come out, so it really, it kind of, I don't know, for the kids out in the sticks that never got a chance to see, like, the bands that were playing, it was their first taste of what, they could only read about it. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't experience what it was about. And that was the first time people could really experience, like, this thing called punk rock, you know. So it meant a lot. It I don't know where it got to. It got somewhere in the charts, I don't know, maybe like 40s or 30s or something like that. It got somewhere in the charts, yeah. Which was a miracle, total miracle. And, yeah, because I remember Dave, we did the John Peel show. Instead of Dave saying at the beginning that you're really going out with him, he said something like, oh, well, are we really number 34 in the charts? Or something like that, you know?
Are we really 65 in the charts?
Roger Armstrong, who would play a big part in the Damned's future, had formed Chiswick Records and run some record shops and stalls in London, and was at the core of the punk rock movement.
We were selling Iggy and the Stooges albums, MC5 albums, and you know, sort of, we were actually supplying the punk, what became the punk crowd, with their copies of these records. So we were kind of in the heart of it, really, you know. For all I know, kind of Brian or Captain or Rat or somebody came in one day and said they had a band, you know. I mean, there was... I'd tell you probably who it was. It was probably through Chrissy Hind.
I was working in a shop called... it was after Let It Rock, Before Sex. I think it was called Craft Must Wear Clothes, But the Truth Loves to Go Naked. And that's where I was hanging out with Malcolm. And I went to see the New York Dolls at the Rainbow Room above Biba's. Steve Jones used to come in and hang out. This is pre-Pistols. Malcolm and I had been in talks. He wanted to put a band together. And he had an idea for a band he wanted to call the Masters of the Backside. And his idea was that I was going to be playing guitar, but more as just a guitar player, not singing or anything. And he had two singers in mind. So we got on a train to meet the one singer. We went out to, I think it was Hemel Hempstead. And it was this guy, you know, he was just a young, dark-haired, nice-looking, well, it was Dave Vanian. He was called David Zero at the time. And then we went to somewhere in the East End. It was a shop, and there was another guy. I think his name was Dave White. There was the two Daves. The only problem with David White is that he didn't want to sing in a band. But Malcolm was so sure that he was the right guy for it. You know, he had the right look. And Malcolm didn't really have any technical or musical skills as such to draw on, but he certainly knew what a vibe was, and that's how he seemed to put it all together. He had also said he met a terrific kid drummer at a party who was a kid. It was actually Chris Miller. He'd never heard him play, but again, on vibe, he knew he was going to be good. Well, this was Rat Scabies, and, you know, Malcolm was right, actually. So far, the Masters of the Backside were me on guitar, Dave White, Dave Zero, this kid drummer, Chris Miller. And Chris Miller said, I've got a mate who can play bass, and I guess guitar. And he brought in another kid from Croydon named Ray Burns, not at all punk, but the most musical person. Well, obviously, Ray Burns becomes Captain Sensible.
Yeah, well, Chrissie Hynde was always there, you know. I remember one rehearsal we did behind Brian James's back, I might add. It was a pretty good lineup, but we thought the band was better, you know, with Brian. So we didn't end up working with Chrissie, but she was always there, you know. I mean, she wanted to be a guitarist, singer, not a kind of... Not a bird kind of singer, you know, in the accepted 70s sense, where the record label kind of manipulates and kind of, you know, uses them in a sexist way, you know, which is why the punk was great for kind of girls in rock.
And we put together some songs. I suppose they were cover songs. And we played a few numbers. I never heard from the guys again. Because obviously once they had the dark-haired Dave, Rat, and the Captain, they could see they had the nucleus for a really good band. And they just sort of left the rest of us in the dust. And so, I would say with, you know, once again, it might not be a popular opinion, but without Malcolm, you know, these guys wouldn't have met each other.
So Chrissie Hynde, later of the Pretenders, was almost in the Damned. So too was Lemmy from Motorhead, according to Rat.
Before we got Dave and Captain in, we used to hang out in Portobello Road in a big pub in the corner. And at the time, I think Lemmy's drummer was in prison. And so Motorhead were unable to work. And it was very cool because Lemmy had, you know, just made a conscious thing of, right, my boy's away, so there's no band until he gets out, you know. It kind of really Lemmy sort of cool philosophy, as it should be. And we'd watch him in the pub playing the Fruit Machine, and we'd look at the back of him and he'd have his bullet belt and the leather jacket. And it transpired we knew that he was an MC5 fan. And you got to realise back then very few people knew the MC5 were. You know, they were kind of a vague recollection, you know, to most. And because of that, and because he was a bass player and he wasn't doing anything, we always thought, well, maybe we should ask Lemmy if he wants to work with us and play with us, you know, but we never really got the courage up to go and speak to him. He was too intimidating and scary. But it's funny, he's always been around the edge of the dam from ever since, well, you know, I say always, you know, but certainly for the first 10, 15 years, there was always a Lemmy kind of presence.
In the mid-70s, there was a lot of turgid kind of prog rock. I mean, some prog rock's good, don't get me wrong. But there was a lot of 20-minute drum solo nonsense, and it seemed that these virtuoso musicians who were most educated at the Royal College of Music were intent on climbing up their own backsides, you know, and boring us all to death with these, like, songs about pixies and wizards and stuff that couldn't relate at all to people from, you know, ordinary working-class people. And I think that's what we were trying to do with the Johnny Moped Band was... create something different, which was kind of relevant, you know, and sing about sort of stuff that we knew about.
The Johnny Moped Band, that was a great band. And of course, Captain Sensible had a lot to do with them. They were all part of this Croydon scene.
But we were kind of really into Frank Zappa and Soft Machine and this kind of jazzy stuff. You know, improvisation, and we honestly thought we were kind of seasoned jazzers after we'd been doing it a couple of years. That in actual fact, the truth was we couldn't play our instruments, you know. But the thing is, if you kind of just throw your hands around the guitar neck and the sax player just like sort of makes kind of screeching noises, it doesn't sound a million miles away from Miles Davis and John Coltrane, you know what I mean? So that's. I mean, there was an element of kind of... And we took an element of the glam thing as well, because we loved Sweet and Slade. And we thought the next thing was going to be kind of a really... really raw version of kind of glam jazz. and we used to have Johnny Moped, the singer. And Johnny Moped used to come out of a dustbin. He would sing the first song in a dustbin, and it would all the screeching feedback from the microphone if you're in an enclosed space and everything. And this is when we were playing youth centres and kind of and pubs and stuff like that. We were bottom of the bill. Or talent contests, I remember us doing once. And the compere came up halfway through the song and said, "Nice try, lads. Go on, sling your rook." But, Moped had come out of this dustbin painted green. with Food Dye, you know, and everyone, of course, will shriek with laughter. But all the other bands in the audience at the talent contest and that who could play perfect versions of Wishbone Ash songs, you know, and Queen songs and everything, they never got anywhere because, I mean, they were brilliant musicians and everything, but the Moped Band had this spark of chaos that you know, which is why we all kind of so comfortably became part of the punk scene, which was, you know, pretty chaotic.
Brian James, meanwhile, was already playing in another band.
The prototype for the Damned, really, was a band that started off in England and then moved to Brussels called Bastard. I played in a band called Bastard, but we just could not get a gig over here. In England, it was useless. No one put us on. We had quite an outrageous stage act. We had strippers on stage. We had all kinds of things, and we was full-on rock and roll, attack rock and roll. And apart from the odd sort of festival, like free festivals with bands like the Pink Fairies and Hawkwind, like kind of like-minded people in a sense, revolutionary types, we couldn't do a thing over here. So we moved to Brussels and lived there for a couple of years. We gigged there great. People were into the music, played in France, Holland, all over the place, did really well. And I came back one year, basically to eat, back to see my parents and have a good meal and all this sort of stuff, you know, lay off everything for 10 minutes. And during the course of that, I answered an ad in Melody Maker. And it was for a couple of guys looking for a guitar player who was into the Stooges and bunch of other bands. This is the first time I'd seen the Stooges even mentioned in like a wanted ad, if you like. And so out of curiosity, I went up to London, checked them out, met these guys, and there's a guy called Mick and a guy called Tony. And I found out these guys were actually into the same kind of music as I was. They were into Iggy Pop, the MC5, and all these bands that nobody else seemed to have heard of in this country.
I auditioned for a group called London SS, and through that I met lead guitarist Brian James, and also the main songwriter of The Damned.
I teamed up with these guys, Mick Jones and Tony James, and we auditioned, and finally this guy come down, this crazy guy with ginger hair, who just set out to demolish the kit. The drum kit we had in the rehearsal place, which was actually in Paddington, and he got nicknamed Quickly Rat because a rat, this is a true story, a rat ran across the floor just as he was scratching himself and saying to everybody concerned who was in the room, "I've got scabies, excuse me." A rat ran across, and Mick, who went on to form the Clash, he said, "Oh, you're Rat Scabies," and it stuck. The name stuck. Anyway, the short end of it is that I really like Rats playing. I got off on it. We just fired together. It was real good. The other two guys didn't like the way he looked, and they were a bit kind of concerned about him being a bit wild and all this sort of stuff. They wanted someone kind of like a tame drummer, you know, and who looked like a pop star. I wasn't interested in pop star looking people. I just wanted to play good music, you know.
It was the greatest punk band that never was. London SS. Tony James, later with Generation X, Mick Jones, who went on to form The Clash, and Damned members Brian and Rat.
I went and played with them a few times, and got my hair cut, and I think that was part of the problem, was that when it came to making the decision as to whether I was going to be in the band or not, I think, you know, somebody decided they didn't want me, and Brian always said that his attitude was, well, you know, this guy's perfect for me, you know, I want to work with him, and, you know, we've been looking for nearly a year. Too bad. It's a shame, because it could have probably, if the egos had have allowed it to work, it probably, you know, because those are three of the greatest songwriters out of, you know, all we needed really was Glenn on bass. So, yeah, that it could have been. I don't think it was at the time, though. I think it was very average.
And so Rat and I decided to shoot off and form our own band. And from that, that's how The Damn started. I mean, he knew this guy, Ray, that he used to clean toilets with in the Fairfield Halls in Croydon. So he said, I'd be happy to, I'm a guitar player, but I'll go on the bass. I just want to be with you guys. I want to be part of this.
So I kind of knew him, and Brian was never really sure about Raymond in the band. It was always a bit, you know, he didn't ever say a lot. He didn't really seem to be into things, but he was kind of into avant-garde music and the Soft Machine, and he was kind of into Coltrane a bit and that kind of thing. So again, there was a bit of a common
kind of musical thing, even though we weren't really sure about his personality. And there's no one else around. Let's go with this guy. And, you know, regretted it ever since.
Me and Rat was down to Nashville, kind of like, we was talking to Sid Vicious. And then this guy walks in the door and said to Rat, hey, about that guy, he looks pretty f***ing neat. What's up with him? Let's go chat with him. He said, I know that guy from Milcombe. So we invited Dave over, sat down, had a beer. I think he probably had a Bloody Mary.
I think it was like at a Pistols gig, and Dave was just there to see the band. And Brian looked at him and said, well, you know, he looks real good. He kind of had the whole kind of Rocky Horror Show kind of look with the vampire collars. But he had his hair kind of like the New York Dolls. It was kind of all backcombed. There was only one other contender. It was Sid, really, because he was there that same night. And he looked great as well, because he turned up in like a gold lame teddy boy jacket and, you know, the hair and the whole thing. And he looked great as well, and so, you know, he was invited down, but he didn't bother to turn up. Sort of people that only like the fast songs, and there wasn't anything with energy, and but more importantly, there was nothing that represented our generation. It was kind of, you know, we were kicking in 18, 19, and it was time for us to have something of our own, and the heroes we had were beginning to let us down badly if they hadn't already done so. You know, either through being tedious and boring or through just not actually making any difference to the world that they'd promised us. There was kind of, you know, a lot of resentment about that. And also we had nothing. We had nothing to lose. You know, we were angry. Life sucked. That's what we were. We were blind f***ing anger. People don't realise how there was nothing. There is no alternative. They ain't going to go and work in a bank. You know, you ain't going to get Captain back on the toilets. You ain't going to get any of that. You know, Dave Vanian ain't going to go and dig graves again. When we found the stage, we found our home. That was kind of, you know, despite what people may say now, but we'd got what we were looking for, and we f***ing grabbed it with everything that we had. It was that or the Dolan prison, you know? The first time we played was July 6th at the 100 Club.
Rat talked Malcolm McLaren into letting us support the Sex Pistols. And Malcolm said, you can't use the PA unless you pay me 25 quid. Knowing full well that we were getting a fiver as the support band. And so he said, oh, of course, yeah, we'll pay you, Malcolm, we'll pay you. So we did the gig, and luckily went down pretty good in front of this sort of pretty staunch Pistols crowd, the Bromley contingent, as their bunch were called. So anyway, we did the gig. The Pistols did their gig. And at the end of it, we just ran. We just got our gear out, like, super quick and went for it before Malcolm could start hassling for the money. He never got that 25 quid, no way. We got a fiver, though.
Yeah. I'm Steve Lamack, and this is She Really Going Out With Him? On BBC Radio 2. Early Down gigs were riotous affairs. Punk was new and shocking to a lot of British music fans.
That singularly made it the biggest knife-edge kind of adrenaline night out. You know, the first time we went to Middlesbrough, or was it Redcar, Coton Vale, the first time we travelled north, it was very scary. Not because of what was there, but because we're going north. What are we going to find? What are these people like? You know, we're from London. You know, all we have to do is speak and we're you know, and this whole paranoia. And, you know, you used to get hit and chased a lot if you had parallel jeans and a leather jacket and spiky hair. You know what I mean? So I thought of suddenly being somewhere like Liverpool. And but that was ours. You know, love it or hate it, that was what we did. And a lot of people threw things and wanted to hit us, and a lot of people didn't, you know. And it was that whole reason for being was going on that stage and doing that 25 minutes. And what made it so knife edge was you just didn't know what they were going to do and how people were going to react. People would stand there, you know, like literally with their mouths open, kind of shell shock almost, when people, there'd be nothing between songs. You know, or the odd thing. And then at a certain point, it would either go for you or against you. And then it was like, and like I was saying about Redcar, that was, I got to say, you know, that was the one time we went up there, and this was, you know, half a dozen shows into your career, you know, it was a rumour in London. And we did that one show, and they liked it. And I've realised two things. First of all, was that the band was really valid musically, because this audience had just said, yes, you're okay. And that was in Redcar, which isn't a place that's renowned for being, you know, where they'll go for it because it's trendy or because of, you know, it's just another place in England. But because of that one night, it was, you just suddenly went, we're getting this right, we can do this, and we can have this properly, you know, we can be the business end.
Don Letts.
Well, obviously, being the DJ at the Roxy, I was perfectly placed to capture their performances. And it was very theatrical, which I've got to say put me off a bit. But on reflection, more power to them, because otherwise it would have been very earnest, with everybody almost standing on a soapbox, you know, driving their politics down your throat. And it did need that kind of levity, I guess, you know what I mean, to kind of give it balance. And it was interesting, because they seemed to maximize the potential of the Roxy the most, in that they almost became a resident band and really built up a serious following, you know, because of those performances.
And it was mainly other bands or bands that were forming and stuff who would watch each other, because there wasn't really a punk scene at the time. But if you ventured outside London, I remember one in particular, one gig down at High Wycombe, where there was about 30 people in the audience, and I went to the microphone, I didn't like people with long hair and beards at the time. I didn't think that was very kind of, you know, what we were doing and everything. And I said, I'm not playing anymore until all those beardos get out. Go on, sling your hook. And at that, you know, the entire audience walked out, and we had to play the rest of the gig in front of no people, otherwise we wouldn't get paid. So we just did the gig in front of, like, sort of the bar staff, which was quite funny. And that wasn't an isolated incident either. You know, outside London, punk was, I mean, nobody wanted to know, to be quite honest. And so you did end up playing gigs where the majority of the audience would walk out, because it was... Now it doesn't seem so extreme, but at the time it was considered to be completely over the top. We were playing fast, raw music when most of the bands around at the time were playing sort of almost country rock.
Well, a punk festival, funny enough, it was a two-day festival at the 100 Club. Yeah, sometime in September, because it was on the day that we were in the studios in Pathway with Nick Lowe putting down New Rose and Help. And straight after the session ended, we scurried down to the 100 Club, check out the Pistols, and this new band that I knew, like, Mick and Paul from, called The Clash. And then the following day, we headlined the 100 Club, and because we'd done a few gigs by this time, we'd built up quite a reputation, so we could headline and basically fill the place ourselves anyway then. And that's how fast the thing was moving, from July to September. You know, we'd become a headline act within 10 seconds kind of thing, you know.
I think the Buzzcocks were on that night and stuff, and then the soundcheck, everyone's like sort of going, wow, the damn, they got a record deal and all this sort of stuff, right? Not knowing that we'd been in a day before recording the thing, you know. It was like a big talking point, you know, amongst these young bands, you know. Because no one ever thought, you know, it was going to get record deals out of this. It was just a f***ing huge laugh, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, there was a bit of trouble there. Somebody, and everybody seems to think it was Sid, but no one's actually proved it was Sid, chucked a glass towards the stage. And it hit one of the pillars, and it didn't hit no one in the band, but unfortunately there was a girl in the front row, and a piece of glass went into her eye, and she was blinded in one eye. And we wanted to do a benefit. It was really weird, actually. We wanted to do a benefit for this poor girl, and we wanted to do it in Nashville, but we'd already been banned for the Nashville.
Ah.
there was a lot of gobbing going on. It became a feature of the punk scene. And I really felt, especially for Strummer, because, you know, he used to really get it. For some reason, but I can remember seeing him just absolutely dripping. It was just f***ing disgusting. But I know where it all came from in the first place, and that's from Rat Scabies going to see the Sex Pistols. And he used to stand there and gob at Jones, at Steve Jones, and Jones would gob back at him. And, of course, everyone, you know, it was supposed to be this scene of doing your own thing, individuality. But, you know, most people are natural-born followers, so when they would see Rotten with his clothes all pinned together with safety pins, the next week everyone would show up like that. And when they saw Jonesy and Scabies gobbing at each other, everyone started doing it.
And people say that at our 100 Club gig on the punk festival, that was the first time Sid started pogoing. That might well have been, but Sid wasn't the only one to be pogoing. See, there was another guy. There was a guy... We used to call him the Italian. He used to wear black shades, right, this guy, and he'd have a toothbrush. And he'd jump up and down with his toothbrush. It's just like a mad kind of thing to do, you know? But it was cool. It was cool. It was, because it was, that's part of the thing. It was like, do your own thing. It was like the hippie thing, but in black leather, right, and spiky hair.
Seeing the potential of punk and wanting to get his band the sort of national exposure that the Damned had already managed, Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren set up a package tour featuring the Pistols, Clash, the Damned and New York band The Heartbreakers. It was the chaotic Anarchy in the UK tour. Sex Pistol, Glenn Matlock.
I don't know, it was a bit of a highfalutin mess really. They were supposed to travel in the coach with us, and they didn't because, I don't know, because the bands were supposed to make a contribution to the cost of it, which is what normally happens, and I think Jake thought it would have been cheaper if they went in their own transit van, so that didn't help their cause at all either. I remember watching them, one of the few gigs we did play was at Leeds Polytechnic, and watching the band, and Malcolm, I was standing next to Malcolm, and he said to me, you know, what do you think about them? I said, I quite like them, actually. And he said, well, I think they really bring the show down. You know, like the Clash and the Heartbreakers are great, and then the Damned come on, because they was second billing. And it all goes down, and I thought, what are you on about? It doesn't. But he was trying to create this thing already, and I wasn't party to the calls he was having with Jake, but there was obviously something going on there, and the Damned didn't get on the rest of the tour. They split from the tour, but I was hanging out a little bit with the Damned guys. In fact, I remember hitching a ride somewhere with them. We'd been somewhere and I got a lift back in a transit, and they said they'd rather have been on the coach with us. So there was all this kind of small town politics going on, which the bands didn't necessarily have any control of, you know.
There was only one gig where all the bands played. You know, Malcolm, he invited us on the tour because he knew that we'd basically put bums in seats because we'd been touring around the country, whereas the Pistols and the Clash weren't even heard of then, but the Pistols hardly ever went out of London and did any gigs. When we was doing the like, dress rehearsals, if you like, it was the same night as the Pistols went on the Bill Grundy show.
That group have received £40,000 from record company.
Spent it,
haven't we? I don't know, have you?
Yeah, it's all gone.
Really?
Down the boozer.
What about you girls behind?
Right, you're dead, isn't he, this geezer?
Are you,
your granddad.
Are you worried, or are you just enjoying yourself?
Enjoying myself.
Are you?
Yeah.
That's what I thought you were doing.
I always wanted to meet you.
Did you really?
Yeah.
We'll meet afterwards, shall we?
You dirty son. You dirty old man.
Well, keep going, Chief, keep going. Go on, you've got another 5 seconds. Say something outrageous.
You dirty b***.
Go on, again.
You dirty f***.
What a clever boy.
What a f***ing rotter.
Well, that's it for tonight.
When they got through doing that, Malcolm said to him, their manager said to him, that's it, you've just blown your careers. Then the Pistols will come bundling in on stage, like, well, you wouldn't believe what just happened. On live TV, right, they couldn't stop it, they couldn't put a plug on it. Then the following morning, it was all over, all the front pages, all the papers, right, talking about this disgusting band called the Sex Pistols were swearing at 6 o'clock on a whatever the night it was, Thursday or a Friday night or something. So from being hardly heard of, the Pistols become infamous all of a sudden.
Next thing, we was followed everywhere the length and breadth of the country by Fleet Street, and was banned from playing this, I think, was it 27 or 23 date tour, and we did 3 shows out of it, just because this sort of censorship reared its ugly head, and people wanted to vet our performance. We refused to do it. Heartbreakers, The Clash and the Sex Pistols were quite united in refusing to play in front of, you know, the local alderman or councillor, you know, so he could vet us. But word came out that the damn were prepared to do that. Well, that didn't help their cause at all.
And then we got accused of not being part of the scene and not standing together like brothers and all this kind of crap, right? And it was like, f*** you.
What they were doing was kind of, you know, they were knocking out the competition, because I've always, you know, Malcolm has said, McLaren has said to me since that he regarded the Damned as the only real competition for the Pistols, because we could play and they couldn't, and he knew that that was their weakest point, was the fact that they really couldn't. And when it came to making an album, they had problems. They did well, and also what they made was a, you know, a kind of a rock album with Johnny Rotten.
Hello and welcome to In Concert. Later on, we were, if you were looking in your radio times, going to hear a band called Nuts. But unfortunately, due to mechanical problems with vans and all kinds of problems up there on the M6, Nuts have been unable to appear. So instead, some nice punk rock for you. Would you please welcome one of the best of the punk rock new wave bands, The Damned.
While what became of Nuts is unknown, The Damned became the first punk band to release an album and tour America. Rat Scabies.
Well, we went from the Anarchy tour onto Mark Bolan's tour. You know, Mark was like a real gentleman and looked after us really well. But it was kind of really cool because it really worked well. And, you know, everybody got on and it was a great tour. It was better than freezing in the back of some barn in Leeds waiting for Johnny Rotten to turn up. From then, we decided to take America. You know, this is a band who's never even been on an aeroplane before. And suddenly, there you are, flying to New York to go and play in all these places where all these bands are that have only you've read about and seen pictures of, and there you are going to play there.
What I wanted was a second album, Music for Pleasure, to be a kind of... I wanted it to be a punk thing, but with a tinge of psychedelia. I thought that would be a fantastic combination. So we all decided, you know, to try and get Sid Barrett to produce it, you know. So we're in the studio waiting for Sid to turn up. We're in Pink Floyd's own studios waiting for Sid to turn up. And who walks through the door but the bloody drummer, Nick Mason? He said, sorry, Sid's not kind of well enough to do this, so I'm going to produce. And, you know, what the album ended up sounding like. It wasn't that great, you know.
I split The Damned up. Rat had a bit of a kind of like, he don't like to call it a breakdown. I call it a breakdown. He was setting, you know, he was building a campfire in the middle of his hotel room, threatening to jump out the window after drinking about at least a couple of bottles of brandy. He weren't in a fit state. So he left The Damned. And we got another drummer in, a guy called John Moss, who later on went on to do Culture Club. And it wasn't the same, and the band was falling to bits. First of all, I was lucky enough to be able to play alongside Glenn, actually, from the Pistols, playing with Iggy Pop. We'd become part of his band for a while. And then I teamed up with Steve Bader, so after I got through with Iggy, and formed a band called Lords of the New Church.
Brian was a lovely guy, you know, but he doesn't listen to other people's ideas. He knows what he wants, and he goes for it, and it's fantastic. You know, I really respect and I love the guy. Without Brian, I, you know, might still be cleaning toilets for Croydon Council now. But we were writing songs which were getting kind of overlooked by BJ, and they became the basis of the Machine Gun Etiquette album for Chiswick. You know, without being kind of immodest and that, I think it worked fabulously. It's just, you know, the most playable record, and it's just sustains your interest all the way through. It's like, it's kick-ass, but it's kind of wild and freaked out at the same time.
No longer on Stiff Records, the band needed a label, which is where Roger Armstrong of Chiswick Records stepped in.
The Damned had disintegrated and then come back as the Doomed, and there was a whole issue where Cap moved to guitar, Brian moved on, and Lemmy actually played bass for him for a while. One of my business partners here, Trevor Churchill, I mean, he's not a man that likes punk rock at all, was persuaded one night to go down the Lyceum to see 2,000 people packed in, sort of going berserk for this group. And he yelled into my ear at the one stage, "You mean they're not signed?" And I said, "No." So he signed them. So he did Love Song, we got on top with Pops. The captain found out that you could get access to the BBC's wardrobe department if you're on it. So he wandered off on his own and walked into the Top of the Pops studio in a full wedding dress and Doc Martin boots, carrying his guitar. Apparently the whole place turned around and applauded. He just looked so astonishing. Dave was dressed like sort of the groom. And the producer came over to Rick, who was manning, and said, "Sorry, can't do that." He said, "We've got an exclusive on Bowie's Boys Keep Swinging video tonight. He's in drag, and Bowie's people will freak out at the captain taking the mickey out of them." Which was nonsense. It was the guy who's a bit paranoid about it, you know. And then we'd smash it up, and that was obviously, you know, everybody said, "This is huge, you know, BBC banned it because of the title." And so some stupid story somebody planted or somebody come up with in the newspapers, I doubt it was true at all, that, you know, a whole lot of punks had sort of smashed up a party in Northampton or somewhere, and they were all yelling and singing "Smash It Up," so we got banned, you know, and it was like, oh, give us a break, you know. But there you go, luck of the damned.
In the 80s, the captain's career took a bizarre twist, and he had a number one smash hit record.
Well, you have to understand where I'm coming from. I was a toilet cleaner. So when I joined, you know, a punk group and everything, I was absolutely thrilled. And then it all went pear-shaped, you know, Brian dissolved the band and everything, and we went through this roller coaster of good times and bad times. And I accumulated a bunch of tunes that I'd written myself, that the Damned had rejected. So I got a record contract with these songs as a solo artist. To be quite honest, when you have been a toilet cleaner and you've gone around with a bog brush cleaning 14 bogs a day, you know, you don't want to go back to that. And I ended up finding myself doing two careers. One was kind of, you know, a credible thing with the Damned, you know, being a punk rock guitar player, which I dearly loved and still do to this day, you know, with a passion. You know, if you can call it a job, it's the greatest job in the world. Doing the two things was diabolically difficult, and I actually had a nervous breakdown. I just collapsed. But, you know, I mean, those years were very, very creative, and I look back on great affection, but I was absolutely knackered.
Is she really going out with you?
You know, I didn't have a lot of money and stuff, and the Lords, my follow-up band to the Damned, had kind of petered out. And then we had this news that Guns N' Roses, who at the time were the biggest band in the world, had covered New Rose, and it was like, whoa, great, Jesus, because I wrote the f***ing thing, so I'm going to get some money out of this, so we can, that's it. We on the strength, we moved over to France, and I think it was the worst-selling album or something like that. But it didn't matter, it was more than I'd sold before, like with the Damned and all that, you know.
Led by vocalist Dave Vanian, who took the band's image and music further towards goth, the Damned continued to record and tour for the next two decades. And you can still find them on the road today. Chrissy Hynde, so nearly a member of the Damned 30 years ago, caught up with them live recently.
Fantastic. It was amazing. It was one of the best shows I've seen for years. Clearly they've survived because there is some musicality there. Dave Vanian has just turned into a great showman. And plus he's a crooner. He's got a really great voice. And he's got incredible stage presence. All the elements that I love about punk, they've retained. You know, it's very stripped down. They don't need very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's still going now. I think, you know, it's, I don't really have any feelings about it as such. I kind of like them being out there to keep pushing the back catalogue. The Damned is probably something so ingrained into me. So, if you like, stain. You know that I'll never ever get a true, clear perspective of what it is or what it meant, or because I can only come to the conclusion it means different things to different people.
In 2006, Brian James and Rat Scabies played together again. Rat co-wrote a book and does talks on the search for the Holy Grail, while the guitarist's new band, the Brian James Gang, released New Rose 2006. Dave Robinson again.
The track still makes it. Brian James, I think, is, you know, a great writer. God, I'd sign the guy tomorrow. You know, he's so good. He's still good. A little ravaged like the rest of us, but great. You know, it still works.
Captain Sensible has moved into politics as leader of the Blah Party, while also playing with the Damned and his new wave supergroup, Dead Men Walking, who've also re-recorded New Rose.
Nobody in, if you can call it showbiz, nobody in showbiz can last 30 years without having a stack of music in there. We've kind of been overlooked to a certain extent. I'm not, you know, I'm not bitter and twisted about it. I mean, I rather like the idea of being an underground band, you know, to be in a real punk group, you know, and not being kind of, you know, glossy and talked about, oh, the Damned were wonderful. Because we're still going and it's fantastic.
Is she really going out with him?
Maybe the Damned were never as huge as they should have been. Many remember them just as that other band in punk's first wave, the Pistols, the Clash, and the Damned. But their place in music history is secure. They were the first band to release a punk rock song.
I mean, to be quite honest, when I first joined the Damned, I didn't think it would last more than a few weeks. But we bloody did our best, though, I tell you, this band. I got a feeling inside of me.
It's kind of strange, like a stormy sea. I kind of object to people pointing at me and saying, think, you know, like, you see me, well, I'm all your fault. It's not my problem. I just, yeah, nothing to do with me. You know, I'm not going to accept responsibility for other people. I did what I did, and that was that.
I'm Steve Lamacq. Is She Really Going Out With Him is a USP production for BBC Radio 2.